What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Welcome to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario, and right now I am the presence of greatness, at least vocal and intellectual greatness, Jaxandra Diaz.
Close? How are you?
Yex, right?
Yex.
Yex, all right. Yex, very good. I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can't complain.
Yes, you can, but no one listens, right? No one listens. Where are you from, Yex?
Originally, I was born in Chicago, but I was raised my entire life here in New Haven, right in the hill.
Okay. By who?
By my mother. Okay. My mother was really, I would like to think, a dope lady. She was a really grassroots community leader.
What's her name?
Her name is Nivia Diaz. They called her Tita.
Okay.
If you are familiar with the hill section of New Haven, right where the City Point Bridge meets on Howard and Fifth, there used to be a laundromat on the corner. My mother ran that laundromat our entire lives. So, yeah.
I think that we are closer related than you ever imagined.
I know the Candelario, so we might be cousins.
We are cousins, because I'm a Galarza also.
Oh, wow.
So we are cousins. Look at that. Yes.
So you know my mom.
Yes, I did know your mom.
Okay.
Yes, know her very well. So tell me a little bit about growing up in the hill there with your moms.
I think that I had a really beautiful childhood. One of those childhoods where you don't recognize anything that's going on you except for joy. The side of the hill that I was raised on was really a tight-knit community. It was that kind of space where if your parents weren't around, your neighbor's parents were watching you, and everyone just reared their children together. So I would like to think that I had a really great childhood. I went to Fairhaven Middle School. I went to Strong Elementary. I went to Fairhaven Middle School. My mother didn't want me at Roberto Clemente.
Judgy wudgy.
I was raised inside of that laundromat, and that was a great cultural experience. Unfortunately, my mother has some trauma around her Puerto Rican identity, so she didn't really raise us in the culture. She didn't raise us speaking Spanish. She didn't play Spanish music around us. She didn't want us confused. Those were her words, not mine. I had a really, I think, great New Haven experience at a very young age. I used to play baseball across the bridge at AmVets. I went to a few different high schools.
But before we get there, tell me, because you talk about your moms.
Yeah.
What type of person was she? What are some of the things that you picked up from her that you carry with you to this day?
Yeah, I would like to say almost everything. I feel like a replica of my mother and her life story. Like, she had four kids. I have four. She had one boy followed by three girls. I had one girl followed by three boys. But my mother was like this real grassroots type community leader. I like to say that she was like a hub in a person. She was the person that people in the community could come to. She would direct them to resources, especially Spanish-speaking individuals, and especially individuals who were new to the country. She'd be able to direct them to any of the resources that they needed: tax preparation, welfare services, whatever they needed. She was that kind of guide and that kickstart for them. And I would like to say that I was able to take that model and elevate it through service in the nonprofit sector. She also was this hood mother. Everyone knows the hood mother. Everyone has the hood mother, the person that all the kids in the neighborhood feel safe coming over to that house when kids are having especially maybe behavioral issues or problems at home. They can come there and find a safe place to rest, to eat, just to be kids. And I have become that hood mom. I even have a poem about it. And I am now that mother who, it doesn't matter how loud they are, how much food they eat, all the neighborhood kids know that they're welcomed at my house. So these are the things that I like to think that I carry forward from my mom.
we talked a little bit about identity, right?
Yeah.
Like, and your mom, our moms were very similar in that they didn't want us to learn Spanish. How detrimental is that to development, or was it helpful, or is, you know, some ambiguity in that?
I would like to say detrimental is a strong word, but it's something close to it for sure. I think that my mother did not know that when a child is youngest, it is the most opportune time to teach them a second language or for them to learn multiple languages. My mother came here from Puerto Rico when she was 13, about 13 years old, straight to Chicago. And she was bullied and teased and even beat up about being Spanish speaking. And she always used to tell us, like, I don't want you in a, you know, Spanish speaking class, having to learn English, having a heavy accent. And there was a failure to introduce us to things that are looked at as tools now, advantages, especially in the workplace, but even culturally. Fortunately, that community of individuals who frequented the laundromat were South and Central American, a lot of Ecuadorians, a lot of Hondurans. So I learned some basic Spanish. I would like to say I'm proficient now as an adult. That allows me to speak freely when I travel, because that was always a concern. Like, when I'm in a predominantly Spanish-speaking space, I feel like an outcast. When I was around my family, you know, my oldest brother was born in Puerto Rico. He speaks Spanish. So it was like the older generations of cousins spoke Spanish, and then the little ones were all of these people called fake Puerto Ricans. Like, well, you're not a real Puerto Rican. You don't speak Spanish. You wasn't born on the island. So there was a similar identity crisis. I like to say that I'm not confused about my identity. Other people are. That you had being what would be deemed a dark-skinned Puerto Rican, which is light-skinned in the Black community. They called me Negrita, and that's a term of endearment, but can sometimes feel weaponized. And it was just like I was the little dark-skinned Black girl in the family. So it was interesting. And then the Black side, it was like they didn't recognize that I was Black or mixed or whatever. It was just like, you're the Puerto Rican girl who, you know, talks like you're from the hood, and not like I was actually raised in this culture. My mother wasn't listening to Mark Anthony and Gloria Estefan on Sunday. She was listening to Mary J. Blige and, you know, Mariah Carey.
So you went through these schools and stuff. You bounced around a little. Were there any teachers out there that stood out that helped develop this young poet?
Yeah, absolutely. There are actually two teachers who are still teachers now. I hope they get to hear this. The first is Robert Esposito. So Robert Esposito was my theater teacher at Fairhaven Middle School. And I got a really great foundation in theater that I think has really catalyzed what I do in poetry now. And I believe he's at HSC now. And then I had a teacher named Anthony Sacco, who is my English teacher at Metropolitan High School. I was like in the guinea pig class for Metro. It was in his first year. We was on Wooster Square. We did not have that beautiful building that they have on Water Street now. And he was a great English teacher. And I think he saw in me what I didn't see earlier on. And I've been fortunate to keep in touch with these two educators. Hmm.
Did you, growing up, did you find it difficult navigating as a, you know, almost, you know, Hispanic, Negrita? were people bullying you, mean to you, or did your personality always outshine everything else? Because you pack a punch.
So I think I was born with this big personality. I come from a family of big personalities. And
I can attest to that.
I have one of the biggest out of the family. I think that they will, if a child presented the way that I presented back then, now they would give them diagnoses.
Oh, yes.
Like oppositional defiance disorder. And, you know, my mother really admired when I would spar with teachers. She hated when I talk back to her, though. So there was this cute thing about this cute convenience about when, you know, I spoke up or spoke back. But I think that, like, I've always been an advocate since I was a kid. I used to see kids get bullied and use my loudness and my bigness, my size, to kind of bully the bully out of, like, into being nice, and or at least into not bullying people who maybe not had a voice for themselves. And that led me to places in middle school, like they used to have peer mediation, and they would select kids who would be the mediators, so things like that.
Hmm. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Canelario, and I'm speaking with Yaxandra Diaz, fellow Hillside. But City Point, because I'm from Congress Ave and Columbus Ave, so she's on the other side. But is how small is this world?
The world is so tiny. People say that they have 6 degrees of separation between you and any individual. And I launched a program this summer for New Haven high schoolers, paid internship called 3 Degrees, because I believe our degrees of separation are even smaller. I came up with this idea in 2018. I went to Cuba. But it felt like to that point, no matter where I went in the world, I always ran into someone from Connecticut. Always. And I went to Cuba by myself, solo trip. And I'm trying to have my Eat, Pray, Love moment, and nothing's happening. And then I get out of the water from the beach, and I'm walking on the beach, and this lady. And, you know, in Cuba, you cannot tell who is who. Like, the Cubans can probably tell who's a tourist, but when you're a tourist, you can't identify black from white, from anything in between, who is Cuban.
Because mm-hmm.
It's less about color and more about culture. So
it's all about culture.
Yeah. I'm assuming this woman believes that I am a Cuban and I don't speak any English. And she's like, nice bathing suit. And I want to disarm her and let her know, like, I'm American too. So I go, oh, I got it from TJ Maxx. And she goes, you speak English? I was like, yeah, I'm from Connecticut. She goes, I'm from Connecticut too. So it was like, no matter where I go in the world, I always run into someone from Connecticut. So I believe that this state is not just small. The world is actually smaller than we believe it to be.
Havana is very small. No, Havana is huge. It is big. I love the architecture in Havana. The people, I mean, but the crazy Havana is a disparity between rich and poor. I mean, you turn the corner and you're straight up in the hood. I mean, and they keep you away from it. You know, it's just,
I was there. I stood there, actually. And it's interesting because my driver reminded me of Henry. He looked just like him. And so I picked a bed and breakfast to stay at through Airbnb.
Mm-hmm.
And it came with the concierge service. So the guy would drive me into Havana every day and mm-hmm. and back into the Airbnb.
I took
nighttime.
The public car.
And
I lived on the edge. But
mm-hmm. we would talk every day. And he was like, you know, he has multiple degrees. And he was educated in Europe. And he sent his son to Europe also, his boys, to get multiple degrees. And he said the degrees mean nothing there. That if his wife did not have the idea for the bed and breakfast 20 years ago, they would be struggling financially. But thankfully, because of the bed and breakfast idea, that they have been thriving financially. But the disparity was extreme. And I was there when they still had the two separate currencies. They don't have that anymore. But
the peso.
It was very interesting to say, I still got my pesos. And there's a different dollar for tourists than there is for the civilians or the mm-hmm. citizens there. And
I pushed the envelope. I went to the state run restaurants across the street from the regular restaurants. So they had the tourist restaurants on one side, and then they had the state run for people, where I would pay maybe $5 for a meal in one, but then I'll pay like $1.
Yes.
And so I learned how to dress like a Cuban.
Yeah.
Which is basically nothing.
Yeah,
I would wear like a t-shirt and some flip-flops and some shorts.
That's it.
Carry nothing, no bag, no camera, no nothing. And then I would just go into the state run and then just pay $1 for a full meal, which is crazy. But yeah, the disparity, the dollar appreciation was different. They moved something that's a lot stronger.
And you can probably attest to it. Everywhere you went, there was like these spray paintings or signs that would say Cuba vive, Cuba libre. Mm-hmm. And I had wrote a piece when I came back home that said Cuba no libre, Cuba no vive, because you could tell that classism still existed despite what people think about whatever they fetishize about, you know, communism or socialism. And it's like when it's done well, of course it's done right, but when the powers that be still don't implement it properly, there is still a huge divide. And I was sad. It smelt, the whole of Havana smelled like petrol. All of the kids I seen were barefoot. There was no Wi-Fi available to everyone at large. It was so restricted, but everyone still looked happy and joyful. And I was like, I am spoiled. Americans are spoiled.
You're aware of your sense of entitlement.
For the first time, really. Even as a little poor girl coming from New Haven, Connecticut, mm-hmm. I was like, even someone on welfare is in a better position than, you know,
than the average Cuban.
And just to think about how much money they generate in tourism and are not reinvesting it back into the infrastructure, because Havana looks like, even though, like you said, very beautiful architecture, it reminded me just of I used to play Call of Duty, and the mm-hmm. Havana in there was like crumbles. It was like, you know, and there was like rebar and concrete everywhere.
As soon as you hit the corner, yeah. There's like crumbling buildings and prints for, and people are living in these houses.
Yes.
People are literally living in these houses, yes. which to me was the most surprising thing, is that this is actual home. This is where someone actually lives.
Yeah.
I was super, super shocked when I saw that. No roofs, leaking roofs. I mean, when it rained, I mean, you can just tell like the water was like gushing out the front door. I'm like, I had the luxury of breaking out of Havana. I pretended I was literally a Cuban, and I bought a bus ticket and I illegally traveled all of Cuba. So I went from there to Santiago de Cuba. I went to Santa Clara. I went to Baracoa. I went to Trinidad. I went to Valero. I went everywhere illegally. And I did the same thing. So I feel like I am in great company now, because there's finally someone that I can talk to about it.
I wish I would have had the mind to do that.
No, you don't want, no. Super dangerous, super dangerous.
I had to turn down a residency in Cuba for this November, actually, called Regla Sol, which is a farming sustainability program.
Oh.
And a lifetime ago, I was an environmental educator, did a lot of stuff in agriculture and environmental sustainability. And I was like, I think this would be nice, whatever they're teaching, for me to be able to bring it back to New Haven. But unfortunately, the political landscape and the time that we're living in now, it did not feel safe to potentially travel and get stuck in a country, or I just didn't want to deal with none of the mishaps.
You have to be very brave. When I went there, at the end, it was a Hurricane Maria. So I endured a hurricane in a very poor country. And it was, I mean, I would never recommend it. Be very careful. And I was, now how I think back how brazen I was traveling the island, and the way that I did, because they do cater very well to Europeans.
They do.
But not so much Americans. Yeah. They do. They despise Americans. Even they were calling me a Yankee once they found out where I was from. You're listening to The Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and I'm speaking with a second cousin. She doesn't know the real connection to it, but my second cousin, Jaxandra Diaz. And this is by chance, because I found you on Facebook.
Yep.
Because you're like this poet laureate, you know, everywhere, you're traveling, you're really good at what you do. And I was like, well, I have to interview her because she's part of our community. And here you go. So the connection between me and Alexandra is that my uncle, Henry, my mother's brother, Henry Galarza, actually married Maribel.
My mother's sister.
Your mother's sister, Maribel.
Yeah,
Maribel Diaz, right? Mm-hmm. There you go. So we are. And here we are. This is how small New Haven is, folks. You know, like you see somebody on Facebook and you turn out to be very closely related
distant
to
relatives.
Distant relative. Close, man. That's pretty close.
Yeah.
We're literally like nieces and nephews to a wonderful couple that are now semi-retired in Florida.
Yep.
Traveling the world.
Between Florida and Puerto Rico, constantly, yeah.
That's all they do. did you end up going to college?
I did not. I was this kid that was super academically charged. Like, everybody just knew, like, Yex was going to Yale. Mm-hmm. And I started rebelling my freshman year. I was in one of those households that I'm sure a lot of people can relate to where there was an excuse to be attentive to all of the other children. I had a sister who was really misbehaved and spoiled and another sister that was very sickly, and my brother was the only boy, and it was like, Yex can self-sustain. She's really smart. She doesn't need my attention. So I started wilding out my freshman year for that attention. I realized that the negative behavior was getting my mother's attention. So I said, let me do what they're doing. And I derailed my own course and got pregnant at the age of 15. So I had my first child when I was 16 years old. I still managed to graduate high school, but I was 17 with a one-year-old and another kid on the way. I had three kids by the age of 19. I tried a semester of college. You know what's interesting? I am at an age right now where my oldest boy is now 17 years old. He's in his first year at Albertus for a first-gen college student. And everyone made me feel like you were supposed to know what you wanted to do at such a tender age. Like, you just knew, like, you were ready to sign up to this real big financial responsibility and go to college or go to the military or do something. And it was like, I was frozen. I did not know what I wanted to do. So I just was like, all right, let me go to Gateway. And I did a semester. And I, of all subjects, I failed English. Like, I'm so good with the English language. I couldn't fit in the parameters that academia wants you to fit in. And I was like, you know what? This is not for me. And I was fortunate to create the environment to be a stay-at-home mom until my kids were ready for school. And that's what I did for a long time. So I like to say self-educated, not college-educated. my mentors, and someone gave me this term recently, are mentors at large. So I read a lot. Maribel and Henry had a huge collection of encyclopedias.
Yes, I remember.
And I asked them Howard when I was Avenue. Like 7 or 8 years old
if
I
could
have the old set. Yeah. For Christmas, and they gave it to me, and that's all I did. I just read. I read. I didn't come from a house where reading was valued, but I valued reading, and I read all of the time. So these literary giants became my mentors, and this is where I learned from.
I'm emotional and enthused. So how did you stumble upon poetry, and what nurtured that part of you?
This story is really funny. Jasmari, which is Maribel and Henry's daughter, wrote a poem. She must have been doing poetry in high school or something. And she was in high school, and I was in elementary school still. I was like in the third or fourth grade at the time. And this is around the time where the AIDS epidemic was still really bad. She had wrote a poem about a friend who had AIDS, and I was 7 or 8, so I was still too tender, too young to really fully understand, but it was so compelling. I was like, whatever this art is, I want in on it. I want to do it. And again, I didn't come from a household that really valued reading, so my mother didn't know anything about poetry, but she knew that I loved to read. And she was a thrifter. And I tell this story all the time. She picked up a book, and she didn't realize what a gem that she had on her hands and that she gave to me. But she got me a collection of Sylvia Plath poems. And this started off that trajectory. So I started writing and realized I was really good at a young age. I got published in an anthology when I was like 9 years old, and kept writing. And then maybe around the age of 19, 20, after having my third kid, I stopped writing for about 7 years. I had moved away to Virginia, have another uncle out there, moved down there after 3 years, came back home, and one of the first places that I went, someone invited me out for drinks at, there's a lounge in Meriden, and they just so happened to have poetry that night. And there were two individuals, one who is well-known in New Haven especially. Well, they're both well-known out here. Iyaba Mandingo and Jason. And so Jason Dorsey and like two of some of the best poets. And what they did was so amazing that night that it inspired me to go home and start writing again, like to pick up the pen and start writing again. And I started producing some really beautiful stuff. It was like... I had to reframe the way that I look at writer's block. I don't view it as writer's block anymore. I spent that last 7 years that I wasn't writing, experiencing the world, taking everything in, soaking everything up. And that gave me a lot of content to write about after 7 years of not writing. And I was just looking for places to blow steam. I was not interested in doing this professionally. I always tell people I did not pick poetry. Poetry picked me. I couldn't deny everything that was being thrown my way, all of the opportunities. But I went to this spot in Bridgeport called Poets Realm once, and the rest was history. People started calling me to work in theaters and colleges. So I've taught at UConn. I've taught at Trinity College 5 years in a row. Teach at a lot of high schools throughout the state, public and private. I've done Long Wharf, I've done Schubert twice. These were stages that I used to visit as a little girl in school. I saw my first play, Midsummer's Night Dream, at Long Wharf Theater, and, you know, others at
the Schubert. Nutcracker at the Schubert.
And then I'm on that stage as a grown-up. So these were really nice full circle moments. And like I said, I couldn't deny what poetry was offering me. It was lucrative. Financially, and the social return was like great. The network that you get to develop, and I've gone so far as to becoming a Last Poets Legacy member. So if you guys are familiar with the Last Poets, they are the progenitors of spoken word poetry and what we now view as hip hop. And I open up for them very often, and yeah. I've got Connecticut to a number one championship, our first ever championship this summer. Mm. So, yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing how something can carry us through the darkest times in our lives and propel us to the best times of our lives.
Yes.
How did that poetry save you? Was it a distraction? Was it a crutch? Or was it literally a savior?
Poetry was like a door opener. You know, I learned, so when I entered the nonprofit sector, when I returned back to Connecticut, I was angry. I had this chip on my shoulder. I never wanted to come back here. And I was like, I had to come back here. I ended up with an injury that really changed the course of my life. And I didn't know, like, what God or the universe had in store for me once I came back home. It was like, dang, Fairhaven again. But no, it was like, actually... My city has a lot of beauty to offer, a lot of opportunity to offer. And one of the first things that I did upon moving back was go to the Fairhaven Family Stroll Day. They have this every year. And, you know, there's always a bunch of different organizations tabling. And I'm fresh back from Virginia, so I want to see what's going on in the community. I'm stopping at each table. And Public Allies is there. Public Allies is an AmeriCorps service branch. And they scout for emerging leaders in the community. And I was like, this is a no-brainer. Let me sign up for this. This was my entrance into the nonprofit sector. My mother, rest her soul, was still alive at this time. And I'm just no direction, all servitude, going where the wind is taking me at this time. And I end up serving as an environmental educator. And in that time, I was meeting people who were either in the poetry community or just had connections and heard my poetry. And this is where all of the referrals started. People started referring me, and it was like, okay, this cool little side thing. You know, I get a little commission here, a little commission there, and it was like, this is cool. Mm. And I'm a very competitive person, so it kind of changed a little bit for me when Connecticut seemed to be the underdog in poetry. There's like different types of poetry, and I was introduced to theater and academia first. I was not introduced to this competitive arena, which is called slam poetry. But once I was, it was a little intoxicating, and now there was a competitive nature, like, okay, I want to win. How do I win? So I went on this little rampage, and I started winning everywhere. I went in Connecticut, and I went in New York, and then Minnesota and Baltimore, and then joined the team. And the team was a very interesting dynamic because there are people that you know personally, but you have to show up professionally. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of nuance to it. It's not as simple as being skilled in poetry. Like that's half of the battle. But there's another half that requires you being able to work with other individuals and really create these masterful pieces that have choreography and all kinds of stuff, all kinds of elements to them. So we reformed last year in 2024. We didn't do terrible, but we didn't do our best. And then we came back together this year and got the first ever championship. The Connecticut Slam team has been together since 2011, and they've made it close a few times. They've made it to final stage.
But they weren't powered by Yaxandra Diaz, that's for sure. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. You believe it or not, we've talked for half an hour.
Oh, wow.
And it's time to say goodbye to all our friends and family. With that said, how can we get, or where can we find you?
Find me on Instagram, YesEx. So that's YASS underscore YEX. You can find me on LinkedIn if you want to, if you're very professional. Yaxandra Diaz. Don't find me on Facebook. I am not the same person.
But she is on Facebook, Yaxandra Diaz. That's how I find her, and that's how I stalked her down. And I find all your accomplishments there. You're very proud. And I really thank you for your time. I really
thank you.
With that said, this has been the Electric Drum. I'm Jose Canelario. This has been Yaxandra Diaz. Yaxandra, see, I'm from the hood too. Yaxandra Diaz. And like always, everyone that's out there, thank you for listening.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.